Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Last week we talked with Chris Roberts, whose husband started to go blind after they were married for many years. This week we have a similar story with a little bit different twist.
We met Amy Bauer, a blind oceanographer, in episode number 1437. This week, we'll talk with her husband, David Fisichella, about how they met and developed their relationship as Amy's sight was deteriorating. And we'll also, throughout today's show, be including discussions of a book that he wrote about their life and work together, 7/10, Love, Piracy, and Science at Sea. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from David Fisichella and is one we could benefit from.
One thing I would offer, being a permanent sighted guide, learn your left from your right, because that's something I still haven't done. Amy is paying for my left-right dyslexia every day in bruised shins.
You know, in our relationship, it's the opposite. Nancy knows her left from her right, and she can see. I'm the blind person, and I'm dyslexic. If she tells me to go right, I just invariably turn left. And you're right. It can be painful sometimes.
But I'm learning. Now if I'm trying to tell him which way to turn, if we're inside the house, I'll tell him, go towards the street or go towards the backyard, and then he's fine. Let's start by meeting David and learning about his involvement in blind sailing.
My name is David Fisichella. I am the manager of shipboard science services here at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. I met Amy about 15 years ago, and we were subsequently married. We met when she had a significant amount of useful vision, which has since, over the last 15 or so years, has deteriorated significantly.
Now, I understood that you may have at one time had your own accessibility resources company?
Yes. I began my professional career as an engineer for an aerospace company, and I did that for a number of years. And then I met Amy, and we started dating, and I moved down here to Cape Cod with her. One thing I found out when I came to Cape Cod is there are not a lot of aerospace jobs here on the sandbar of Cape Cod. But I had already had a little bit of an involvement with the blind and visually impaired community as a sighted guide in a blind sailing program in Massachusetts. So I was quite comfortable in that environment. And I did have a kind of a technical background, so I can put two and two together and decided I wanted to try to help people with adaptive technology here in southeastern Massachusetts. So I started a small business doing that I had for about 8 or 10 years, working with people from all over kind of southern New England.
You were helping out in this program with visually impaired sailors. Was that your first interaction with visually impaired people, your first introduction to that?
Yes, it was. I was on a business trip, and I was reading a sailing magazine, and there was a little sidebar that talked about this program that the Carroll Center for the Blind was running that involved blind sailors. And my first reaction to that as a sailor was, there's just no way blind people can sail a boat. So I called more out of curiosity than anything else to find out how it was done. And I was introduced to Arthur O'Neill, who was running the program. He invited me down, and I met some of the sailors and was immediately, you know, taken by the whole process and really got to know some of the people and started sailing with them as a sighted guide. And that's kind of indirectly how I met Amy, because through the Carroll Center, she was going through an Outward Bound program with them, and they had a reception that I was invited to, and that's how we met.
You'd be amazed about blind sailors. Pete could see a little bit as a kid, and he learned how to sail with his dad. He used to take our kids out sailing, and he was the only one who knew how to sail, and they were the only ones who could see. It was an interesting combination because they really weren't old enough for him to be doing that.
It was a lot of fun, though. We sailed those little boats, like the sunfish, I think they call them, where you could, you know, the whole fun was tipping them over when you went a little bit too fast into a turn. If any of our listeners wanted to find out more about this program or similar programs, where would they go?
I would start with the Carroll Center for the Blind website and their outdoor enrichment program. I also know in Boston, Community Boating has an adaptive sailing program as well. Amy and I, after sailing through with the Sail Blind program for a bit, started our own sailing program at the Community Boating. That was a public sailing facility here in Boston on the Charles River, and it seemed like a logical place to try to start an adaptive sailing program. We ran a week-long event there for a couple of years in a row, which was picked up by some of the other people there, and they now still do adaptive sailing.
Oh, cool. Well, we will put links to those resources in our show notes.
And in addition, we found a link to the Blind National Sailing Championship, so that'll go in the show notes too, if you want to take your sailing to the highest levels.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is what it's like having your partner transition to blindness as the relationship is developing.
So I guess we mostly wanted to talk about your interactions with Amy, how you met, and how things progressed. So you told us already that when you guys met, she was visually impaired, but she had a substantial amount of vision.
That's right. When we first met, I didn't realize that she was one of the blind participants in the Outward Bound program. I thought she might have been another sighted guide. But having met her there and found out a little bit more about her vision loss and then got to know her a little bit more, it's interesting how, you know, I accepted her vision loss at the time. And as our relationship started to grow, it was something that was always there. But even with knowing that the potential was that it could get much, much worse and she could become, you know, totally blind in a matter of years or a decade, in that stage of relationship, you don't really think out that far. And you just assume, well, we'll deal with it when the time comes. And over the years, you know, when I look back, her vision steadily decreased to the point where she became a cane user and then ultimately a dog user. And now her vision is extremely limited. But over the years, we've kind of been through that process of adaptation, you know, together. Not to say that it was easy for either one of us. I think it's a difficult thing to have to deal with, but, you know, you get through it.
So basically, when you met, you knew she had somewhat reduced vision and you knew there was a possibility it might get worse, but functionally she could still navigate on her own.
Right. And I, you know, having been around other people with various levels of sight loss, I saw, especially the community that I was interacting with, which was a very active, you know, the sailors and the skiers who were blind, those people were out there doing things. So I didn't see that vision loss was really holding any of them back that much. So I guess I didn't look at it as being as serious as I think some other people might have found it.
So was there some trepidation on either your part or her part into advancing the relationship in terms of kind of having this elephant in the room?
I don't think so. I mean, it's cliched and it's certainly appropriate here, but love is blind and you don't think that far in advance. You think you can handle anything that comes your way. It certainly, as she started losing her vision, you know, there are certainly stressful times in the relationship because of that, you know, you didn't anticipate and you having to learn to deal with all over again. It was, for me, for example, after years of her vision deteriorating and being very inconsistent, I think is a good way to describe it. You know, there were days when she could pull a piece of lint off of my shirt, but a minute later needed, you know, my help locating an object that was right in front of her. So it can be, as a spouse of a blind person, that can be frustrating. You just, after a while, you sometimes question yourself, can you really not see that? Or are you just wanting me to get off my butt and walk across the room to pick up that can for you?
You know, it is interesting. We think about these transitions sometimes happening just overnight suddenly, which can certainly happen in an accident. But often we think that when it happens gradually, that it's a smooth transition. But I remember myself going through high school and undergraduate school where there were some days I just couldn't read my books and I had to get my homework done when I could read my books. And, you know, it just varied from day to day and you never knew.
Yeah, I've heard Amy say that, you know, there were days she just wishes it had happened overnight because then she would have to deal with it and adapt to it right away and, you know, learn Braille or whatever it took. But having it gradually creep in on her, I think, in some ways. I mean, you get the benefit of having an extended time with your vision, but at the same time, you put off making those adaptive technology choices or other choices because you say, well, I'm not quite there yet, or I can keep trying to do it this way. And in reality, what it ends up being is very stressful.
Right. You may say to yourself, I don't need this particular adaptive aid, or I don't need to do things this particular way. And you keep on trudging along when really it'd be a lot easier if you did use some of those adaptive aids.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How has technology impacted this transition for you two?
Well, I think it's been invaluable. I can't imagine where we would be without it. And I say that from the perspective of a spouse of one who is blind and using this technology, and also one who at one time provided this technology to others. It was extremely gratifying to be able to go into someone's home who is struggling reading the newspaper, for example, and being able to show them how to use a CCTV and really changing their life in a meaningful way. So, yeah, you can't underestimate the impact of technology. And had you told me 5 years ago that the most accessible thing a blind person could hold in their hand would be a non-tactile iPhone, I would have said you're crazy. But it's, you know, things like that have made a huge difference.
It does sound counterintuitive, right, but it works really well.
Yeah, I mean, we buy everything for the buttons. And that's starting with, well, our old cell phone we bought for the buttons. Now we have iPhones, which don't have any buttons, basically. Who would have thought? But the microwave and the stereo system and everything we buy is for the buttons. And it's just astounding that Pete's able to use a device that's basically a flat piece of glass.
Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to find a lot of appliances today that have the buttons that you can actually feel or utilize in some way.
It does limit your choices.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we just add tactile bumps to things. And so he can run the washer, the dryer, the dishwasher, and he doesn't cook much anyway. So we gave up on the digital oven.
But we do have Braille on the microwave.
Amy is a great cook and she loves to cook, which is great for Sarah and I, except that we have to clean up. And one of the things about living with a blind person that has always been a challenge is, especially a blind person who loves to cook, is they make a huge mess in the kitchen. So, but I guess that's the price you pay for getting fed.
Pete claims I make a mess cooking too.
So I want our listeners to know also about the book you wrote describing your adventures with Amy, how you got to know her and assist her on some of her oceanographic cruises. And the book is entitled 7/10, Love, Piracy, and Science at Sea. Can you talk a little bit about how you assisted her on these trips?
Sure. At the time we met, I was an engineer for an aerospace company, and Amy was an oceanographer here at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And we were at a cocktail party, and we met and we started talking, and she knew that I liked to sail. And she asked me, right there, she said, would you be interested in coming with me on a research cruise? And I said, that'd be great. That's like totally something unexpected you would hear at a party. But, I jumped at the chance to do that. Later, I find out that she didn't really asked me because she saw me as being some very technically talented individual, but she saw me as a warm body who was willing to go to sea for not a lot of money. Actually, the first cruise, I don't think I got paid at all for that. But my role in helping her was primarily to kind of help her navigate around the ship, getting to and from the ship, to provide assistance with accessing instruments and information that's displayed in the laboratories on the ship that cannot be adapted for her use, deploying instrumentation that she had with her coworkers at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution had developed for her experiments at sea, and just, being her set of eyes on the boat.
How well was she able to maneuver around the ship?
Being on a ship for a blind person is really not as challenging in some ways as some people might think. Because in a lot of ways, it's easier. All the furniture is bolted to the floor. It doesn't move. It's always in the same place day after day.
That's helpful.
So once you get the lay of a vessel, you can get around it pretty well. And they use the term ship shape for a reason. And that's things are typically kept very neat and tidy on a boat for safety reasons. So as a blind individual, it's fairly easy once you know the layout to get around. But a lot of the other elements, such as instrumentation and systems on the ship, are not very accessible. And a blind person does need a pair of eyes to help sometimes.
Now, you describe in your book how you had the experience of being blindfolded and led around the ship as part of a hazing process when you guys crossed the equator. Can you talk a little bit about the experience from your standpoint being blindfolded?
Yeah. So one of the traditions on the vessel, on a ship, is that whenever you cross the equator, the crew members who have been across the equator before will have a equator crossing ceremony that involves some fairly disgusting elements for those who are crossing for the first time. Again, I won't go into the gory details about what we were made to do for a day and a half or so, but
people could read the book if they want to know the details.
Yes. One of the things that they did to us was blindfold us and lead us around kind of in a daisy chain. And Amy happened to be next to me. And the whole time, you know, she was quite comfortable with this experience. And she kept nudging me saying, see, now you know what it feels like. It was quite unnerving to not know, you know, what you're going to bump into next. It was quite an experience. You know, the ship is moving and the deck is pitching a little bit. And to do that when your eyes have a reference point is a lot easier than when they don't. Let's put it that way. I had the same experience with another program that I participated in, a program called Ski for Light. And that's a cross-country skiing program for blind and visually impaired people. And I was and still am a sighted guide in that program for the last 20 years or so. And one of the training elements that they do is they make all of the sighted guides spend a number of hours blindfolded, being led and guided by another new guide in training. And that, again, that's a very enlightening situation to go through. But I learned a lot and learned all about trust.
It does take a lot of trust.
What issues have come up because of Amy's blindness?
One of the things I find difficult being the only driver in the house is that I'm kind of like, I feel like the single parent of two preteens. And I relish that the rare occasion when I can sit in the passenger's seat of a car, because I'm driving Amy around and I'm driving our daughter, Sarah, around all the time. But I realize when I am in the passenger seat of a car that in those rare occasions that you are giving up a lot of control. It can times be a little unnerving. And I realize for Amy how she must feel not being able to see everything. And all of a sudden the car stops. You know, I stop the car suddenly and she doesn't really know what's going on. I haven't had time to explain it. I can imagine it's a scary experience.
I can certainly resonate with Dave's feelings about being the only driver in the family. And we had two kids, so there were all four of us to get places. And I would go out of my way to do things efficiently. We would make four concurrent appointments with four different people at the same hair salon at the same time, just so I could do it with one trip. But the flip side of that is that as the only driver in a family, when one of our friends gets into a situation, maybe they broke a leg or who knows what, where one of the drivers in what's normally a two-driver family won't be able to drive for an extended period, I'm like the only one of their friends who offers them rides because I understand what it's like having a one-driver family. And they're always very pleasantly surprised to get an offer of help because no one else realizes that it's extra overhead for the driver.
Well, as I recall, you tried to set up some carpools for some of the kids' soccer games and baseball games that we had to drive them to. And many of the other parents, their first reaction was, why? Why should I want a carpool? Until we actually talked them into doing it a few times, and then they were hooked.
Oh, yeah. Carpools are awesome.
So you mentioned your daughter. Now, I know in the book you talked a little bit about some of the discussions you and Amy had about starting a family and having a child. And, you know, we had similar reticences. I was always worried about, gee, when the kids are crawling around, maybe we should put bells on their feet so I don't step on them. Can you tell us a little bit about the conversations you guys had?
There was some trepidation. It was mostly on Amy's part. I felt 100% confident in her abilities as a mother. It's just who she is. I knew she would do a good job. But, you know, you do talk about those what ifs. You know, what if I'm not home and she's alone with the baby and something happens? You know, how do you react to that? What can you do? But, you know, you recognize you can't protect yourself against every situation and potential hazard. And you just have to, at some point, we just said, we're going to jump into this and see how it turns out. And it's somewhat of a leap of faith, but 12 years later, it turned out okay. They'll ask me tomorrow and I might have a different opinion.
Yeah, when our kids were little, I mean, Pete did everything, and including changing diapers, which a lot of our friends didn't and they could see. But the one thing he wouldn't do was give the kids a bath until they were big enough to sit up, just because he was afraid they'd drown. And that was fine. You know, I'm all for safety. And one day when our son was maybe 2 months old and he was our second, and so he had, you know, waited a good 6-8 months with our daughter before giving her a bath, and I came home and Pete had obviously bathed Brian, and I said, "Oh, you gave him a bath." And Pete looked at me and he said, "I had to." I don't think he was happy about it, but, you know, Brian was fine and nothing happened. And he was just careful and used his skills to overcome the fact that he couldn't actually see and made sure to keep the kid's head above water the whole time.
Yeah, for us, Amy being a scientist and me having an engineering background, we tend to overanalyze everything. And we take things step by step, especially Amy's guilty of this, where she wants to look at all of the potential, you know, situations and have answers for everything before she takes the next step. But when it comes to child rearing, being blind or not blind, it pretty much you take your chances and you go in and do the best you can.
You know, it's interesting being scientists, as we are too, and we tend to plan and make sure all of our ducks are lined up before we do something. Being blind, a certain amount of structure and planning is very helpful and sometimes even necessary.
You know, that is something that as a spouse you tend to can get on your nerves sometimes because you just want to do it, you know, let's just do it. But, you know, she has to be much more prepared before she does anything than I do or Sarah does. So it's something that, you know, we just learned to deal with, and it's not always easy. You know, one of the things that we have that are challenging, especially for me, knowing that Amy is a powerful person, she's got an important scientific career, she's accomplished and, you know, professionally very independent. But there are times when she's asking me to do things for her and I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, can't you do this for yourself? A lot of times you do it something for because it's just quicker and easier for me to do it. So I just do it. But there's a fine line between that and feeling like I'm being taken advantage of because, you know, I know that she can do something for herself. And little things like that, after years and years, they can be a source of friction. If you don't confront them. The converse is true also when, you know, Amy wants to do something, and sometimes I feel it's just easier for me to just do. So I step in and we'll take over and do it. And I recognize that, no, she really wanted to do that herself because it's something she could do and she, you know, she had control over and she could do it her way. And I just came in and did it and screwed that up.
Well, we sometimes run into that issue too. And there's a fine line between helping and, you know, sometimes the visually impaired person may feel that, you know, I did want to do that myself. I didn't ask for help, even though the other person is trying to be nice. And so there can be a trade-off there.
Yeah, occasionally you're the person who grabs their elbow and kind of pushes them across the street, even though you know that's not the right thing to do.
Right.
Right. There's hope. After about 15 or 20 years, I figured out not to do anything for Pete without asking first. I can't tell you how many times he told me that it's not a favor if you don't tell me you did it, and it may not even be a favor if I didn't want you to do it in the first place. Now for this week's final item, some concluding thoughts and how you can get David's book, which we highly recommend.
After that discussion, do you have any other thoughts that you'd like to add?
And I think there's probably one other thing that comes to mind, and I recognized this just recently. You know, if Amy had not had severe vision loss, she still would have been a very, you know, good and accomplished scientist. But when I look at the things that she's done since losing her vision, a lot of these things are related to, you know, working with other people with vision loss, working with students at the Perkins School for the Blind, trying to learn how to make science accessible for people who are blind and visually impaired. And some of the recognition that she's got from that, and that some of the places we've traveled and the people we've met, I realized that in some ways we've had great experiences because of her vision loss. And it's not a consolation by any means, but it's a change. Our lives would not have been the same had she not been blind. And not necessarily all in a bad way, is what I'm saying.
And do you have any regrets?
You know, one of the things that I struggle with is, you know, I know that I'm not always the best sighted guide. It's just something that I wish I could be, you know, better at. But it's, you know, you're not going to be on the game every day, every minute of the day. And, you know, I know Amy deserves more, but she's stuck with me, so...
Well, that's a good thing. You know, my screen reader crashes sometimes too.
I've only ever walked him into one mailbox and one pillar. So I'm proud of my track record over 31 years.
You're a keeper.
Yeah. She is.
We both read your book cover to cover and really enjoyed it. It was a very engaging read. If somebody's interested in getting a copy, where can they get it?
It's available on Amazon. For the blind and visually impaired people, it is on the Talking Books Library. And if somebody still has a problem finding it, they can always email me with any questions. I'd certainly love to talk to people about the book or our experiences.
And your contact information?
My email address is dfizzicella@whoi.edu.
Can you spell Fizzicella?
It's F as in Frank, I, S as in Sam, I, C-H-E-L-L-A.
I should point out that the book is also available in an electronic format from Bookshare.
Yes, and on Kindle as well, I think.
And be sure to check out our show notes for this episode if you want to find out more about some of the sailing programs and the skiing programs that he talked about, as well as his contact information and where to obtain the book. Just go to www.eyesonsuccess.net.
That's it for show number 1443. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the recently released KNFB Reader app for iOS devices. Devices for performing optical character recognition, or OCR, have become much less expensive and much more technically advanced. Now you can have the power of a state-of-the-art OCR engine on your iPhone with the new KNFB Reader. We'll talk with James Gashel, Vice President of Business Development for KNFB, about the app and the history of OCR technology. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboo.fm at Eyes on Success, or Twitter @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.